G'day, Annie. Hello to all of your listeners. And can I just start by congratulating you on that wonderful interview about Papua New Guinea?
Great.
Yeah, there we have, you know, our closest neighbour, really. And I plead guilty to being someone who is quite ignorant, really, about life in Papua New Guinea and the nature of our relationship. I thought it was a terrific introduction for someone like me who should know more than I do.
Yeah, yeah. Well, anyway, I'll go to the speech and start collecting the information, because you're completely correct. I mean, as Margaret pointed out, we're only 100 kilometres away from them. That's less distance than the country town I was brought up in from Melbourne.
Yes, and it's a big challenge. How do we wrestle a anti-colonial Australian relationship with Papua New Guinea instead of the traditional colonial one?
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm no expert on that. But I'd just like to congratulate you and the woman whose name I apologise.
Margaret Ryan.
Yeah, well done. And to both of you, it was terrific.
All right, so today
we've got lots to talk about, haven't we?
Yeah, yeah. Well, a complete and audible relief that the LNP were kicked out.
So many of us who have worked for that for a long time and despaired at the collapse of momentum in 2019, if not despairing, at least very frustrated. And now we have, all of us who have worked for the change of government can justly celebrate, but also gird our loins for the years ahead, because remember, this government has been elected on a very small target platform.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was in fact their entire strategy: create a small target.
And very, very effectively done, by the way. I think as soon as there is a history of Albanese's major speeches since he became leader of the opposition, will show that it was a very crafted and disciplined strategy. Whether it's one that is going to deliver the goods is going to depend, in my view, not just on what the government does, but what the people do as well. And when I say deliver the goods, I mean govern in the interests of the majority of Australians, not in the interests of the major corporations and so on.
Well, I know that there's...
You might be interested to know, Annie, that this weekend the Australian Financial Review has released its annual rich list.
Oh, yeah, yeah, go on.
And so we have familiar faces in the Financial Review's rich list and also some new ones. I'm not going to go into all the gory details, but I should alert your listeners to the idea that there have been, you know, big percentage increases in the wealth of Australia's richest people.
That's right.
Over the last 12 months or so, recovering very quickly from the minor losses they suffered during the height of the COVID pandemic, and which is not to say we don't have a high COVID pandemic right now, but there you go. So it's all publicised in the Australian Financial Review, which you can get at your local news agency and even read online if you're into that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as a recent analysis of the wages stagnation versus the profit reaping of the upper end of town has revealed, it's almost balanced.
Yes, well, the rich list, the wealth in the rich list is taken straight out of the profiteering that goes on, both in the real productive part of the economy and also in the gambling dens of the stock exchange and the bond markets. So they've been doing all right. I think the election result was, terrific and provides some scope for a new momentum, if you like, to pursue and shift the government into being a much better government than it actually was promising to be. We have seen some good signs, I think some really good signs so far of the government itself. There are some specific things in which they have mark themselves out from the dark ages of the past, particularly with the voice to parliament priority and the way they're talking about it. And then secondly, you know, we have this quite humane and sensible and correct decision around the Murray-Guffin family and so on. So these mark the government out as being open to much more progressive influence than their minimalist program perhaps would provide.
There was a lot of tinkering with the actual machinery going on, despite, you know, wanting huge change. The LNP were actually undermining the actual machinery of our democracy.
Yeah, and I think that a majority of people in many, many electorates have gone way past where the Labor Party was at with its program. I mean, in regards to the climate change, the status of women in society, parliamentary governance and behaviour, in that regard, the people themselves are to the left of the new government's program.
Yep.
And not in every electorate, and it's not evenly distributed, but it's there. And I think those of us like me who are to the left of the ALP and the Greens, this is a terrific challenge for us as much as it is for people who are fixed within Labor Party and Greens and so on.
It's interesting you should bring that up because the Greens' success in Queensland is marked by the fact that that part of the party is left, more left than other parts of that party, if you know what I mean.
Yes. Well, to be honest, I don't really know that from my point.
Well, the conversation has that these are the people who push the agenda of the environment centre stage, the people who are deeply committed to removing the inequalities, who are aware of things like the cashless debit card, all those types of things.
Yes, yes. Well,
as opposed to the ones
I've heard of similar stories in electorates where they haven't won as well, where they have significantly increased their vote on the basis of a broader program around both climate change and living standards, especially for people on very low incomes. So I think there is a chance for the building of an alliance, and that means, you know, there is an opportunity to challenge any sectarian behaviour that dominates amongst the apparatchiks within the ALP and the Greens who prefer to hate each other rather than work out how to develop a strategic relationship for the benefit of nature and for the benefit of the majority of the population.
It's funny you should say that because yesterday, I think it was Mel's, was giving, I saw him give a speech and he was talking about something that Morrison did, you know, like a day before the calling of the election over a boat arrival from Sri Lanka, right? And Mel's says, this is outrageous, putting political party interests ahead of national security, right? And I thought it was interesting because, you know, what he was implying, saying was that there was a bipartisan belief in border security and that should transcend any political carry-on, right? And it makes you wonder why the environment doesn't fit into that category.
Well, I think the answer to the wondering is this, is that the environment or nature is the source of all commodities that we need to one degree or another and which are exchanged every day. And every single one of those commodities must make a profit. And therefore, there is going to continue to be dispute over how the destruction of nature, instead of its constant restoration, is going to be prevented. How the destruction of nature is defeated. And in capitalism depends upon the ongoing destruction of nature on balance, with some minimal restorations to give the impression to the majority that everything is going to be okay on that front.
Yeah, yeah.
It's embedded in the way in which the system, the economic system, the society, it's endemic in the way in which capitalist society operates, that climate change, what's going on with nature in even a broader sense, is going to be in permanent conflict until the situation is resolved with an overwhelming momentum to restore nature on a global and a local level, interacting with each other. That is a part of the economy. The natural world is not separate from the economy because it's the source of all the billions of commodities that are a part of daily life.
That kind of leads into this thing I've been developing, which is the, and you started it off with the rich list, the corporate bludgers list. And how it's been that corporate bludgers have been using our political system in order to feather their nests and to imply that, do a whole round of greenwashing. And for example, starting big destroying fossil fuel sort of enterprises right under the nose of an electorate that is saying that we need to deal with climate change. How do you see this playing out?
Well, that's how that plays out. Two of the top ten rich listers in the new list are Cannon Brooks and Twiggy Forrest.
Who are right into
saying that transnational corporations like theirs are the solution, provide the solution to climate change. In other words, the hyper-exploitation of people in Australia and other countries is okay because with that hyper-exploitation, they can dish out a portion of their profits to pretend that that's going to be reversing climate change. So they're right into the greenwashing. How this plays out is going to depend a lot, in my view, on mass movements. What we've got is a shift towards a more progressive Australia in terms of the ballot box outcome. And there is a mood and a vibe around that. Can that be sustained? Can that be turned into even greater momentum that is better than the government's program? That is not going to, in the end, depend purely upon parliamentary and electoral activity. It's going to depend on extra parliamentary mobilisation.
Sorry, Annie.
You see, the Reserve Bank itself and reserve banks and other economic institutions around the world are saying that we are heading for another recession. Modify that a bit. The Reserve Bank of Australia says that there will be a collapse in Australia's current growth rates to a half next year.
A collapse.
It's a downturn, right? That's a halving in growth in 12 months. That's what they predict. Now, that potentially enables a neoliberal type economic leadership from the government that will introduce a milder form of austerity, but austerity nevertheless in the way it runs the budget and associated economic management. That's what this Labor government is more capable of doing than the opposite, which is to manage this process in the interests of the working class majority. The only way we can prevent that and push the government into a working class majority orientated management of the economy is through continued mobilisation that is at a higher and more sophisticated level than what we have been doing. There is not going to be a parliamentary solution in the interests of the majority without those mobilisations. And so I think that the period ahead is really important. We have the annual wage review now this year coming to its final stages, and we'll have a decision. And the government, probably going further than it really wanted to go, is writing to the Commission to argue that whatever its decision is, it must not cut the living standards of, it must not be below the inflation rate. That they're not putting a number in, but they're saying not.
Yeah, I know. I noticed that they didn't do that.
In some ways, they could be doing and saying a lot more than that. But the ACTU and the union movement could be doing and saying and doing a lot more than they are as well. So what the government is doing is reflecting and responding to a demand, a mood out there, but only as far as it needs to go. We need to make sure it goes a lot further and intervene into those sorts of things. There is going to be this audit before there will be a budget. Mm. I think, from what I understand, they're going to try for an October budget, which will be necessary. That is a focal point for all of the low-income organisations, all of the various types, and environmental organisations to start building a movement that doesn't go away just at the end of the year, but builds progressively and steadily. But lets this government know that if there is going to be a downturn that is serious, that maybe morphs into a recession, then they've got to manage that in the interests of the majority. No austerity.
That's the
focal point. And that's a big deal for those of us who are members of the ALP, but to the left of it, who are members of the Greens, but to the left of it, and who aren't in either party. And I might say, just in conclusion, I want to send a shout-out to all those people who, there weren't many, but there were people who did stand in these elections as socialists. They got only small votes, but better than they have been getting in recently. But there are a lot more people out there who are of like mind, and I think it's terrific. And really, it's actually courageous and intelligent that there are people willing to go into election periods on a socialist-style platform, because we have to have that, because that ultimately that is how we reduce the rate of exploitation. We reduce it seriously with socialist ideas, particularly in the area of energy production, where there must be a restoration of public ownership, democratic public ownership, based on democratic just transitions. This government is also going to run an employment summit. This is going to be a focal point also. Let me just say one thing before we finish. That ALP running tripartite, multi-partite summits have been a mechanism to dilute their electoral program.
Yep.
And that's what we must stand against. A full employment summit conceptually is a good idea, but normally what conservative ALP, pro-capitalist ALP economic management means is that it wants to dilute the program that it has already taken to the people and to get endorsement for that and therefore acceptance from the people. Well, we must prepare to resist that.
What? So you were saying diversionary spectacular?
Well, that's what it could be. I mean, that's the way in which Hawke did it. Rudd managed it in a somewhat different way, but that's the way in which Hawke managed it, when it was a spectacular, but it diluted the program that they went to the people on in 1983.
And he was the master of promotions.
Yeah. So I think, for those of us who are socialists, this is a rich opportunity. I think there is really good. It is essential for. Take the annual wage review, for example. There are some straightforward reforms to the Fair Work Act that would be in the great interest of women. For example, changing the language, the statutory responsibilities of the review, so that it must pay attention to reducing the gender wage gap in its decision. Secondly, and most importantly, taking away the consultation process and replacing it with collective bargaining.
Walking the talk instead of carrying on with false platitudes.
These are all about what is the role of government in ensuring that working people have more democratic power at their disposal, starting in the workplace and starting and proceeding through their industries. That will be the mark not just of this government, but of the union and labour movement generally, being able to mobilise public sentiment to demand that of the new government against its own preferences.
Yes. So many more things to talk about, even down to the way the mainstream media has been telling us all about the Liberal Party, even though they lost constantly. Pictures, free publicity. It's unbelievable.
I don't think we can rely upon mainstream media to enable public discussion about building a mass movement.
No, I don't think so either. Thanks very much for talking to us this morning, Don.
All the very best to everybody, and we'll talk again soon.
Yeah, thank you.